Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, which, like it says in the tin, is the weekly technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week we're talking about, yes, sex. The web is full of dark corners, and technology aims to please. So this week we're having a poke around at the bytes that make our bits excited. Joining me to debate the highbrow and the lowbrow of digital hanky-panky is an esteemed pair, Bobby Johnson and Zoe Margolis. Welcome to you both. Now, Zoe, you're in the middle of a book. You're finishing up a book, I believe, about sex blogging. How is it going?
It's going very well. It's my follow-up book, Girl with a One-Track Mind Exposed, Further Confessions of a Sex Blogger.
And how does this extend and does this move things on?
Yes, it is the story of, unfortunately, me being outed and losing my anonymity and then trying to maintain what sort of dating life I had left whilst knowing that everybody knew every explicit horrible detail of my sex life for 3 years prior.
I imagine that there was a lot of research that went into this book. And by that, I mean, you know, looking around to see what's out there on the web. Have you managed to wander down any rabbit holes?
A few. You'll find out more in my third chapter.
Oh, my. I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, Bobby, have you ever been tempted to peer down rabbit holes yourself?
I've been down plenty of rabbit holes, Alex, but not so many of them as filthy as you seem to be suggesting. I think there are a few famous examples of weird internet sex sites. Sex with dolphins springs to mind. But I did once stumble upon some David Beckham Michael Owen slash fic.
Really?
And that left me looking at football in an entirely different way.
Well, on today's podcast, we'll be challenging the rumor that it's sex that propels technologies in the mainstream by speaking with Brenda Brathwaite, producer of the only AAA game that's ever been explicitly themed. And not explicitly rated, by the way. That would be Playboy the Mansion. Brenda's also the founder of the Sex and Games Special Interest Group of the International Game Developers Association, and she'll be explaining why gaming appears to be the only technology that hasn't been successful because of sex. We'll also be chatting with Zoe, the girl with the one-track mind herself, about the real-life implications of being outed as a sex blogger. Is blogging a public activity that has no right to anonymity, as a high court judge ruled a fortnight ago? Zoe offers her thoughts on the implications for the thousands of people who prefer to keep their identities a secret when they're online. All this, plus the news in this hot and heavy edition of Tech Weekly. Computer games are, generally speaking, and I say generally speaking, the preserve of teenage boys. And so you'd think that when the regulations warn of adult situations and they're talking about games, that they'd mean the between the bedsheets action. But in fact, more often than not, they mean violence. Now, while there have been some high-profile controversies about intimate situations and interactivity, like the so-called hot coffee incident in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, in which an explicit scene that had been left in the code was uncovered by an underage hacker, there really hasn't been a whole lot of sex in AAA high-profile video games. Brenda Brathwaite is the head, or I'm sorry, was the founder of the Sex and Video Games Special Interest Group for the International Game Developers Association. And Brenda, you are a veteran developer of games, both sexy and non-sexy. Thank you very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Pleasure.
Brenda, can you give us a little bit of a background about how you fit into this whole conversation?
Sure. Back in 2001, I started work on a Playboy game, and it was already in production, but I was brought in to, I guess, bring the game to port is a way to put it. And so naturally, like any game designer, I wanted to know what had been done before in this field, and I really found that very little had been written about it. So also in true game developer form, I then began to research to a ridiculous degree. And found that there were other developers who were also out there working, you know, more or less as islands, who were not networking, who had not talked with one another, who were, in fact, in some cases, afraid to let other people know that they were working in adult content. So working together with the IGDA, we started a sexual content development SIG for people who were working on adult games, and there were a number of them. And then I guess as a true testament to my ridiculous research ability or my inability to stop surfing, would be another way to put it, I ended up writing a book called Sex and Video Games.
Well, my very first experience of sex and video games, which sounds like we're having a group therapy session here at the minute, was a game that was it was a German game, and I can't remember exactly what it was called. It's called, oh, I remember, Lola Virtual Babe, which was more of a sort of interactive play thing. But it certainly wasn't, it didn't have the content, it didn't have the gravitas of something like the Playboy the Mansion game, which is what you produced, which was a very much a high-profile, console-based AAA title. Why would you say that historically games have not been sexy? When you look at technology in general, it seems that technology has risen up because of the ways that sexual content has been exploited through these products. Why would you say that games seem to be the only content device that hasn't?
Well, it depends on which side we look at, right? I mean, there have been tons and tons and tons of sex games made, mostly independent titles. But if we're going to look on the commercial side, it's an easy answer, and that answer is ratings. If you get an AO rating here in the States, that's the kiss of death. It means that you're not going into any big box stores. It means you're probably losing 70% of your sales just right off the bat. And you know, take a country like Australia, where there's not even a rating for mature titles. So to get your game in there, it has to be playable by, I think, people under the age of 15, if I remember correctly. Otherwise, it is refused classification. So if you are a developer and you're going to put significant money into something, it's just too big a risk to take. And so you end up seeing things like, I mean, even Fahrenheit/Indigo Prophecy was edited when it came to the United States.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so some of the stuff that's in the game in the UK didn't make it over here.
And it ain't, it's not even that saucy.
No, it's not. But it's that perceived risk. You know, do you want to take that chance? Do you need to take that chance? And so I really believe it has held back the interactive storytelling potential of video games.
Well, why do you think that, regardless of this idea of interactive storytelling, which in and of itself is its own genre of video games, why do you think adult situations should be featured in video game content?
Well, I guess because, so if video games, well, if they are, so video games are my medium, and why should I be limited to the content that I can cover? Nobody else in no other medium has this kind of limitation. Filmmakers don't have it. Books, arts, music, you know, nothing. I mean, I was listening to a Prince song this morning, right? Nobody has this kind of limitation that video games have. And so that's not to say that we need to have interactive sex scenes in every single game. Clearly, that's not the case any more than it's the case that we need to have that in books or movies. But if you wanted to tell a story and you want, you know, when you sit down to develop something, you just want this palette in front of you and you will pick and choose what you want. You know, and if you're making a game, you know, for a younger audience, let's say you're making a platformer, clearly you could care less about this entire, you know, let these characters fall in love. But if you think of some really amazing movies that have been made, you know, these conflicts, these are at the center of them. You know, and we couldn't even come close to making something like that in video games right now.
Bobby, what do you think about this entire scene? Obviously, you're living in the States right now, but, you know, you may have had access to more explicit content when you were living in the UK.
I think there's a definite cultural divide between Europe and America, and I think Britain sits with its stiff upper lip somewhere in a completely different different planet. But I think, you know, the fact that most of the big gaming companies come from quite puritanical cultures has something to do with it. I think the other thing I was wondering is whether we can ever get over the uncanny valley, because when you look at sex in games at the moment, the fact is that it's not very sexy. It's kind of, it's like, you know, watching manga porn or something. It appeals to a niche of people who can kind of place themselves in those situations. But because the graphics aren't there, or because things don't look realistic, people find it quite hard to place themselves in those situations. I mean, Brenda, do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Uncanny Valley, I refer to them as plastic people. And then there's another version of the game where they look like zombies. So neither of those things turn people on.
Not so sexy.
Much at all. And so in the polygon race, as you know, it affected the mainstream game industry. It also affected the sex game industry. Didn't go over nearly as well as I think people would have hoped. And we're actually seeing, among several models, like Bonetown, for instance, has returned to, you know, a more abstracted, you know, they're clearly not photoreal. There are certainly photoreal engines, and that is something that they struggle with, and they're very aware of it. And then we can go all the way to the non-graphic side of it with something like Darkroom Sex Game, you know, which is where you use two Wii controllers to get each other virtually off. And there's no graphics. No graphics at all, hence the Darkroom part.
Zoe, what you had something you'd like to say.
Yeah, it's more of a question really to Brenda. I'm just wondering why you think there are such limitations on how sex is portrayed within video games in comparison with other mediums like you've suggested with film or with books.
Well, you know, it's the perception. It's the same perception that comics faced a long time ago, that comics are for kids. You know, and even, you know, at the very beginning of the segment we talked about, you mentioned Grand Theft Auto and the hack that was found in it. So that guy was actually, you know, well above the age of whatever. He certainly wasn't an underage guy. And largely, it's that perception, and we have to get past it, that video games, like, you know, comics aren't just for kids. I mean, you think of something like V for Vendetta or even Mouse, right? You know, comics are for everybody, and likewise, so are games. And even if we looked at like the marketing stuff, you know, some of the latest stuff by the people who research this is that, you know, gamers are, the average gamer is a guy in his 30s, his upper 30s, no less. So it's a perception issue. And the second that somebody gets rated AO, it's for adults only in the United States. And I don't know necessarily that you would want to, you know, just rule out an entire market or develop extra content for some other market. So it's just not a safe place. And because we're not experimenting in that, we're not experimenting on developing relationships in games or on integrating, you know, maybe more sophisticated narratives into games that you would see in TV or in film, we don't have that body of knowledge to build upon. Like, oh, look how they did it in this game. Maybe we should try this. We just don't have it.
At this year's Game Developers Conference, I sat in on a panel that was absolutely superb. It's called the Game Developers Challenge. They do it every year with different types of ideas where esteemed game developers have to come up with a game design. And this year's theme was My First Time. And it was absolutely stunning. Brenda, I saw you in the audience. Can you tell me a little bit about, or tell us a little bit about some of the games that came out of that? Because that, I think, is some of these really demonstrated quite a nice way of integrating some of these elements, some of these features that you're talking about that would work very well in interactivity.
Sure. You know, in fact, if we just go one step back, like, so just thinking about why don't we have sexual themes in games? So Kim Swift couldn't participate, right? Originally, Kim Swift was supposed to be the one where Heather Kelly and I forget her name now, Kim Swift was supposed to be there. So she wasn't allowed to participate because of the theme. Oh, my goodness, sex. And so, you know, that just gives you an idea of what we're facing. The Heather's her submission was a series of mini games, and I think the favorite one is, you know, counting tiles on the ceiling. And it was a series of mini games that really poked fun at the first time. And then contrast that with Steve Moresky's, which was literally left. So, you know, I've known Steve for a very long time, and there were other people in the audience who have known Steve, you know, for 20-some years too. And Steve is a pretty private person, and he created this, you know, beautiful talk in this game called Wait, Time Passes, which is about, you know, how he was this incredibly geeky guy and he went to MIT and, you know, and there he was even outnumbered, but that eventually, you know, he found love in his life and you know, that first time. And it was really wonderful. It was an incredibly intimate and potentially horrifyingly embarrassing discussion, but it was great. I agree with you. It was one of my favorite game design challenges.
This is unfortunately my final question. This is such an interesting discussion. We could go on for hours, Maybe we will someday. But finally, if we're talking about integrating sexual content in games, and you mentioned before that we've got all of these different international cultural divides, whether it's in Australia, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in the US and anywhere else. If we started to integrate some of these interesting concepts into games, regulators would freak out. Surely they have enough to cope with already, don't they?
Well, they do. Yeah. But, you know, there's a ton of sex in games already that we are not even aware of and that we never program in. The emergent sex that shows up in game worlds like Spawn, or even much larger, if you have an MMO and a chat interface, you will have it, right? I mean, ultimately, human beings are not always turned on by computer characters. They are most turned on by other human beings. And so as games become this increasingly social medium, it's already there. We've already got it. And that's, you can't rate what may or may not happen.
Well, many thanks, Brenda. And if you'd like to find out more, then head over to the Games blog, where we do try and address this topic on a regular basis with much fun. I have to say, it's fascinating. The blog is at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now here's Bobby with the latest technology news.
After causing controversy with its plans to install monitoring software on every computer in China, officials in Beijing have delayed the scheme at the very last minute. The installation of the Green Dam software, which was due to become mandatory on July the 1st, has now been pushed back after pressure from PC manufacturers and other companies. Swedish software firm Global Gaming Factory has bought the notorious file-sharing site The Pirate Bay in a deal worth almost £4.7 million. Details appear to be fuzzy at the moment, but Global Gaming suggested that it could turn the site, which saw its founders convicted and fined £2.4 million earlier this year, into a legitimate concern. Apple boss Steve Jobs is back at work, according to the company, just a few months after a secret life-saving liver transplant. The iPod maker confirmed that Jobs has returned to day-to-day business after 6 months of medical leave, although he'll be working from home part of the time. And if you're one of the millions of people with a drawer full of old, useless mobile phone chargers, help could be on hand after manufacturers agreed to adopt a universal standard for charging handsets. The plans, based on current micro USB ports, have been approved by 10 of the world's largest phone manufacturers and should be industry standard by 2010.
Many thanks, Bobby. And you can read more on those stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. A fortnight ago, the police blogger Nightjack was outed by the Times newspaper. Richard Horton, a special detective from the Lancashire Constabulary, had a temporary injunction against the newspaper to keep his identity a secret. But a High Court judge ruled that he had no right to anonymity. His high-profile blog had offered behind-the-scenes commentary about his force and had been critical of the government. And the reporter had claimed that Nightjack, or Richard, had been in breach of public disciplinary regulations and his commentary was not up to the standards of professional behavior which we expect of our police officers. The judge agreed. A couple of years ago, Zoe, you experienced a very similar kind of public outing. You were and still are the girl with a one-track mind, a very high-profile sex blogger who led a double life. Can you tell us a little bit about that whole scene, that whole experience?
Yes, well, funnily enough, it was the sister paper, the Sunday Times, that got rid of my anonymity and outed me. I was leading a double life, like you said, writing a private, secret sex blog, very anonymous, trying to limit the information I put on there about friends and family so that nobody could identify themselves, and got a book deal off the back of the quality of the blog and the amount of attention it had received whilst I was anonymous. And on publication of the book, the newspaper somehow got hold of my real identity and outed me, and it was a horrendous experience for me.
What were you doing? I mean, ultimately, what were the implications for your offline life? How did that clearly, you know, with the anonymity and with the mask, you were able to express yourself in ways that you possibly wouldn't have been able to do offline. But at the same time, you know, you were leading a normal human life. What happened there? How did it affect that part of you?
Well, I didn't say anything libelous or slanderous about anyone, but I was extremely explicit about sex and about my own life. And that made it incredibly difficult, if not impossible, for me to continue in the career that I had. Certainly, I was working on a child's movie at the time, and it was said to me in quite a few ways that I wasn't welcome back into the industry, and I was effectively blacklisted, so I lost my career, which was a massive thing for me. But I've tried to make lemonades out of lemons from it, and sitting here talking to you today, it affected everything for me in a very personal way, not just professionally. And it was incredibly difficult to have to face friends and family and try and explain that I'd been careful about information that I put online, but yet still there was a lot of information there about me and about situations I'd been in that they might not like to read.
Some interesting commentary has come out of the Nightjack case. For example, I know that the High Court ruled that blogging is a public right, is a public activity with no right to anonymity. How do you view that? Do you think of the two environments as something that should be kept secret? Should bloggers be able to be anonymous?
Well, I'm sure lots of people would disagree with me and say, if you're going to put something out there, have the balls to stand there and actually say it on a street corner with your real name attached. But I would argue that there is a real, genuine need for people to protect their identity. What's happening in Iran right now is a great case for that argument. If those bloggers who are getting those messages of real violence out there, if their names were known, their actual lives would be at risk. And if we're going to have laws, which now seems to be the case, that anonymity is irrelevant online, anonymous sources can be named, then journalists are going to be impacted, not just bloggers, and also anyone else who's putting quite risky information out there, which I wasn't, and I don't think that Nightjack was either.
Bobby, at the same time, Nightjack was putting out critical information about the government, about his force, and these types of things. So surely at this point, somebody should have stepped in, because it was against the disciplinary actions. It was outside the remit of what he would have been allowed to do anyway. So surely there's a case here for this kind of outing.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about Nightjack, which makes it more complex, and certainly, more complex than Zoe's case, where she was, writing about something which I don't think was ever fair to argue was in the public interest. But I think he was writing about something which really could easily fall under whistleblower laws, and whistleblowers do get protection from the law in terms of what they're saying about their employers or the companies that they're related to. To me, I think this is a really tricky issue, because I don't think anyone has the God-given right to anonymity, and everybody should be accountable. How can we tell if you are being libelous until we know who you are? It's a bit of a paradox, I realise, because once we know who you are, you're no longer anonymous. It's very tricky. But I think ultimately it comes down to this tension there is between the growing idea that information wants to be free and should be free, and the consequences of that. And that's both the human consequences, the political consequences, and the legal consequences further down the line.
Zoe, we're speaking a little bit about this idea of regulation, of ultimately how you regulate the content that you put online. You said that you were very careful not to implicate any of your friends, any of your family, and all that kind. How do you regulate what you put online, or how did you regulate that so that you could still retain the freedom with which to express yourself, but at the same time make sure that nobody else was implicated?
I think you just have to be careful to try and protect people's identities. Just changing names, places, dates, etc., and keeping the circumstance real and maybe the dialogue real of a situation that's happening, but changing enough information so that if someone looks at it, they really can't recognise themselves. I hope I was careful enough, and I haven't had any criticism from the, dozens of people who were in my life who unfortunately have read it all since then. They've all said, I'm okay with it.
Do you think one of the reasons why you were brought out in such a public way was because of the content. I mean, for example, if you'd been an anonymous person writing about beekeeping, for example, do you think there would have been a furore? Was sex the reason why you became such a public figure?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you just look at the articles that were about my outing, calling me shameless and seedy and sordid. And in fact, there was an article justifying why I was outed, which was that, you know, I'm sort of shameless and that it was a marketing gimmick. My anonymity was a marketing gimmick, which it absolutely wasn't. There's an idea about how women express sex and sexuality. And I think there's some very old fashioned journalists out there who think that they'll sell more newspapers by making it into this sort of shameless, seedy, sordid type description. And I don't fall into that, but that's how I was put across. And I've had to fight ever since to change that.
The anonymity that you were afforded by being online is something that is potentially very, very helpful and very useful for other people. So what kinds of implications do you think there are for people? They use the web for this type of thing, for catharsis or for self-expression, particularly when it comes to sex. What are the implications for these findings for these people?
Well, I think when I was outed, that suddenly was a wake-up call for a lot of bloggers, and also especially for a lot of female bloggers who suddenly feared that their lives would be thrown into disarray as well. And I think there's a real double standard about how women are portrayed in terms of sexuality, and being able to write online anonymously and express yourself if you're female is a wonderfully freeing and expressive thing. And that suddenly got brought home that, oh my God, I might lose that. And this ruling is even more worrying, really, in that regard. I think anyone who's anonymous online now needs to be seriously concerned and seriously question what they're putting on there and how they would cope if suddenly everyone knew who they were.
Well, thank you very much, Zoe. And how is the book? Because you're currently writing another book.
I am, which is due out March 2010.
Yes, well done. And I'm sure we shall enjoy reading that as much as we enjoyed reading the first one. That's it for this week's edition of Tech Weekly. Thank you very much to our special guests, Brenda Brathwaite and Zoe Margolis. Thanks as always to Bobby Johnson and Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky, and I have thoroughly enjoyed today's recording. Now it's time for some chocolate. See you next Tuesday.